This is Crime Binge.
Welcome to Crime Binge,
the podcast,
where this week we are on episode 58, where we are covering the Upstairs Lounge.
And the Upstairs Lounge was a gay club in the 1970s in New Orleans, becoming a literal and metaphorical sanctuary for its patrons. One night, a fire was set and 32 people died as a result of smoke inhalation or from the fire itself. And although it wasn't a hate crime, support didn't really come from the community in this, and that kind of turned it into a hate crime almost.
Yeah, essentially. Like, this community was so disenfranchised that no one was willing to help them, and it's just really, like, fucked up.
It is.
Yeah. But before we get into all of that, let's get into our regular bit, Sarah. What are you binging this week?
So, Morgan.
Yes.
This week, I'm binging a podcast.
Yeah.
And it is The Darkest Timeline with Ken Jeong and Joel McHale.
Fun.
And for people who do not know, they are both stars on the show Community, which was my binge a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And this podcast isn't like, there's so many rewatch podcasts out right now, like The Office Ladies.
Yeah.
And I know Scrubs has one right now.
Oh, really? Didn't even know.
Yeah. And this isn't that because they're not watching all the episodes and talking about it.
Yeah.
They start off because Ken Jeong used to be a doctor. And for the first like 30, 40 minutes, they talk about COVID-19 and what's happening that week.
Yeah.
And interesting. All stuff like that. Yeah. And Joel McHale actually interviews like a famous doctor like on the side who's a researcher for COVID-19.
Okay.
And so they both are kind of knowledgeable about it. And so they talk about that for the first half. And then they usually have a guest come on from Community.
Yeah.
And they'll like answer questions, but they only end up getting to like one question because they just keep reminiscing. And so it's a lot of fun. The majority of the time they just like rag on each other.
Yeah.
And nothing gets done. But there right now there's only 17 episodes, but each episode's like 2 hours long.
Yeah.
And I'm only on episode like 7, but I've only been listening to it for like 3 days.
Nice.
Yeah.
So it's an easy binge.
Definitely. And the thing is, it's a podcast.
Yeah.
But they also record it for YouTube.
Oh, fun.
And I think that they forget, since they're recording and they can see each other,
yeah,
that other people that are listening as a podcast can't see them. So they like show things like,
oh,
old,
yeah,
memorabilia and stuff. And so if you are going to partake in it, I would definitely recommend watching it on,
yeah,
YouTube as opposed to just listening to it. Makes the experience a lot better.
We do the same thing though, and we don't even record, yeah, it. We're like, look at this weird smile you're making, and, yeah, it's like no one can see the weird creepy smile you're making.
Yeah, they had Gillian Jacobs on, and she was like, I have this merch and this merch and this merch, and it's, she's like, I have this poster and this and that, and I'm just like, no one can see it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's really funny. And we're, me and my fiance are still watching Community. We're on season 5, so we're almost done.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just really good because you learn like the inside secrets of it. And they're like, we had to take this like take 70 times because this person wouldn't stop breaking. And
right.
It's just fun to learn. And it's a show I really enjoy. So.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. So, Morgan, what is your binge for this week?
My binge this week is another book. It is called The Game of Desire by Shan Boodram. She is a like sexologist that I've been following on YouTube for a little while and also like on Instagram. And I know she wrote this book and I've had it for a while, but I just never read it.
Okay.
And it is a really interesting concept. I meant to look up the name of the other book that I'm thinking of, but there's this like famous book written by men, plural, a man who like is a pickup artist and trains men to be pickup artists through this book and like How to Get the Woman You Want, basically.
Okay.
And so this is her version, essentially, of like giving women the tools for like confidence of how to get whoever you want.
Hell yeah.
And that's like the reason I think it's so interesting is because, one, I think I've talked about it on here before, is like I think sex and relationships are really cool, and like I don't think as a culture in America we really talk about sex and relationships that much. Yeah. And it's like kind of weird that we don't. But her whole thing is like, you work hard in your life for your work and your job. That's the same thing. Like your job and your education and everything like that. Like you study to make yourself better. So why wouldn't you also do that in your relationships? Like do things to make you like the best version of yourself, essentially.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. And it was just like, it was a fun read. I read it like in a day.
Hell yeah.
And she gives lots of good advice if you're already in a relationship. It is mostly written for like single women to like take on the life and, you know, do what you want. But it is also like an experiment because she physically takes 6 women and like does this experiment with them to see if doing all of these things makes you like a more confident dater and getting the kind of person you like want to attract.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's like a really interesting concept and like kind of crazy. There's some stuff in there that I'm like, wow, you're wild. But yeah, it was just overall like a very interesting book because it's crazy. I don't know. That would like, be, I don't think I would ever like, even if I saw an ad to like do that experiment, that I would do it, you know?
Yeah.
Because it took them like a while because you're bettering yourself. So you're like learning what toxic traits you might have in a relationship and, all you know, them. What you can do to be better, like that kind of stuff. So it's interesting.
Yeah, that's cool.
Since it is the last week of June, we did want to do like a little Pride Month episode. And the reason we're covering the Upstairs Lounge today is because it's kind of a very unknown thing that happened even within the community itself.
Yeah. And like I saw maybe one other small podcast do it.
Yeah.
And they did like a 20-minute episode tops on it.
Yeah. And it is interesting because there isn't that much information on the case because an investigation wasn't thoroughly done. But we're going to talk about this later. But this was like the biggest mass killing of the LGBT community before Pulse.
Yeah.
And no one really knows about it. So we wanted to cover it because, one, it's an arson case. And two, we think it's important if we're going to be covering like Black history, to be covering LGBT history. And truthfully, LGBT history wouldn't be history without Black history, because the Stonewall Uprising was pretty much Black trans women who started it. So just a thought.
Yeah.
We got to intermingle them. But with that being said, because we keep forgetting to mention this on the podcast, but in our descriptions the past month, we've been putting places you can donate to. And for this month, I wanted to share places that I'm going to be donating to in case y'all wanted to donate to them. So one is going to be the National Black Justice Coalition, NBJC, which is a civil rights organization that's dedicated to the empowerment of Black, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, in same gender loving people. And then also the Trevor Project is a really good just LGBT.
Yes, I've definitely heard of that one before.
Yeah. And they're also really awesome. And that's who I'll be donating to for a little bit of Pride Month celebration.
That's great.
Yeah. And also, this is kind of our celebration for Pride Month since people don't really get to celebrate this year, you know?
Yeah, there's no parades, there's no parades, no nothing like that.
Yeah. This year we're all taking the time to reflect on ourselves
and learn more.
Yeah.
Like, go out and research something that you didn't know happened, like we did for this case.
Yeah. And it's an interesting one. So should we just get into it?
Let's do it.
Let's do it up.
So like we said before, the Upstairs Lounge was a gay bar, and it was on the second floor of a building on the corner of Chartres and Iberville Street in the French Quarter of New Orleans. The building, in total, did have three stories, and this bar was known as a friendly neighborhood bar that offered gay men a safe place to gather and enjoy each other's companies. The Upstairs Lounge was also one of the only interracial gay bars in the area, as we all know racism was strong at that time, even in the gay community.
Yeah, and it still is today, actually.
Wow.
Not as much, by the way. It's not like blanket statement, but it is still an issue.
The manager of the bar was also the bartender and an Air Force veteran, and his name was Buddy Rasmussen. And he was known to be friendly to all patrons of the bar, no matter their race. And he would also even let in women when, at the time, gay men and lesbian women were strictly separated and they didn't, like, mingle or hang out at all.
Yeah, which is so interesting.
Yeah. The Upstairs crew members had an anthem that they would like to sing at the piano that summed up their unique approach at the time. And I couldn't tell if it was either the name of the song or the chorus of the song, but It said, "United we stand, divided we fall." And although the French Quarter had a reputation where anything goes, which I'm pretty sure it still does, let's be honest, being out was still unthinkable. And during the 70s, gay bars were routinely raided. But New Orleans was known as the queer capital of the South. On Sundays, the Upstairs Lounge hosted a weekly beer bust where they offered free beer and dinner to 120 patrons. And some sources did say that it was like a buck or two. Some said it was free.
Yeah.
So it depends. Again, like we said earlier, there's not a lot of information on this. Yeah. A lot of conflicting.
Either way, it was a cheap beer and a fun night.
Exactly. And the event was often attended by the members of the local Metropolitan Community Church, which was a pro-LGBT Protestant denomination. The Metropolitan Community Church was the United States' first gay church, and it was founded in Los Angeles in 1968. The local congregation had even used the Upstairs Lounge Theater as a place to hold services before they got their own building.
Yeah.
On Sunday, June 24th, 1973, the final day of Pride Weekend that year, the regular beer bust was taking place. Apart from the final day of Pride Weekend, people were also celebrating the 4th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising. And this evening, there were about 60 people at the time who were listening to a pianist, David Gary, perform, and were also discussing an upcoming fundraiser for the MCC for the local Crippled Children's Hospital.
So during the celebration, some drama ensued when a 26-year-old man named Roger Nunez walked into the Upstairs Lounge. Nunez was a regular patron, but no one that frequented the bar didn't really like him and didn't bother to learn his name. Upon his arrival, some people were heard saying, "He's here again."
Yeah, they were like, "Really? This guy?"
Nunez was drunk when he arrived, and before going up to the bar to be served, he hurried straight into the bar's bathroom and took up one of the two stalls. He stayed in one of the stalls and began gawking at people through a peephole using the next stall. And he would either say encouraging things or harass them, and people didn't know if he was trying to make friends, start a fight, or was just trying, like, a weird tactic in order to pick up the men to have sex. So he just, like, showed up to the party shitty and was just annoying immediately.
Yeah, and, like, don't look at other people while they're in the bathroom stall, while they're pooping.
Yeah, and don't be weird. But quickly the line for the bathroom was packed and people started complaining because he was just taking up one of the stalls.
Exactly.
And one man named Michael Scarborough went into the bathroom and was harassed by Nunez. But Michael was a tough man who didn't take shit from anyone. So afterwards, he went to tell Buddy, the bartender, about the event. I like that he doesn't take shit from anyone, so he told another grown man about his issue.
Right? That's so funny. Yeah, he, like, in the article, it said that he, like, made even the bartenders, like, call him sir. And, like,
oh, yeah.
His dad was the biggest balesman in the city, and he just, like, he knew he was all that.
Yeah. So, Buddy and another man pulled Nunez from the stall and told him to leave people alone. Having seen Michael and believing that he was a snitch, Nunez spotted him at a table with his partner by the piano. When Nunez started shouting at him, Michael stood up and punched him in the face, knocking him to the ground and leaving him writhing in pain. Michael later said, "He came over and started agitating me, so I jumped up and just knocked him down." Buddy then has a decision to make. He can either kick out Michael for throwing the punch or kick out Nunez for instigating the fight. And he decided that since Michael was a well-liked patron and Nunez was not liked, overly drunk, and had already gotten into trouble, Nunez was going to be the one to leave. But before he was able to get up, Nunez shouted, "I'm going to burn you all out." But no one really believed him, except for one man who just peaced out of there. He was like, nope.
Yeah, he was like, ooh, it's time for me to get the fuck out. Like,
when someone threatens a fire, it's like, I've been out too late tonight.
Yeah.
As Buddy and another man dragged Nunez out, he was spitting and kicking, and someone recalled it took two or three people to get him to the upstairs door. There was an altercation to get him out, even out on the landing, and he left the bar sometime between 7 and 7:30 p.m. Around the same time, Buddy had to kick out an 18-year-old patron as well, telling him never to return, as a teenager tried stealing the bar's mugs and began pouring out people's beer onto the floor. Also, someone who just doesn't know how to have a good time, it sounds like.
So, it said that he was, like, trying to take the mugs because in some states, not like Florida, you can, like, he could get deposit on him if he took them to the store or and recycled them. So he was, like, trying to steal them, and Buddy was like, no, fuck you.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, fine, and just started pouring beer on the floor.
It's not a cool move, man.
Yeah.
Party foul.
So around 7:56 p.m., so about a half an hour after Nunez gets kicked out, the buzzer from the downstairs door sounded, so bartender Buddy Rasmussen asked another well-known patron, Luther Boggs, to answer the door. They were expecting a cab driver, and, like, this would happen all the time, so the cabbies wouldn't have to walk up the stairs to the second floor. They'd just ring the bell, and Buddy would just kind of push out whoever was waiting on a cab. Instead, when Boggs opened the door, he saw the front staircase engulfed in flames and could smell lighter fluid. The stairs, being in a hallway, created an updraft that sucked the fire up and engulfed the walls with flames. Buddy Rasmussen immediately led about 20 patrons out of the back exit to the roof, where they could access a neighboring building's roof and climb down. There were also windows in the bar that went from the floor all the way to the ceiling. And many people saw this as their escape path. But there were bars placed on the windows with only 14-inch gaps between them.
Yeah.
And these bars were put in place to prevent the dancers from breaking through the glass if they fell or anything like that.
That means that you dance hard as fuck.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you dance with everything you've got.
You know they're having a good time.
Yeah.
Several people did manage to slip through the bars and fall to the ground, and some of them were still on fire when they hit the ground. Luther Boggs, the man who answered the door and discovered the fire, pushed his female friend out the window before going out himself, still on fire. A neighboring bar owner was able to put the flames out on Luther Boggs, but his injuries were too severe and he ended up dying later. Reverend of the MCC, Bill Larson, managed to remove an air conditioning unit that was at the bottom of one of the floor-to-ceiling windows. And this part's just a little graphic. When he tried to escape through the hole he had made, the upper pane of glass from the window fell, trapping him against the window frame as he was halfway out the window.
That's sad.
Mm-hmm. And he died due to the fire, and his charred remains were visible to onlookers for hours afterwards. And he's seen in many of the photos taken of the front of the building after the fire was put out. And the photos are graphic. I have seen them.
Yeah.
MCC assistant pastor George, his name, they called him Mitch, mm-hmm. Mitchell, managed to escape the building, but then realized that his partner, Lewis Broussard, was still inside. Mitch and Lewis considered themselves married, and as gay marriage was very illegal at this time, they considered themselves married based on a civil ceremony that they had 2 years prior. So Mitch went back into the building to rescue Lewis, but neither one of them escaped the fire. And their remains were found inside of the building, clinging on to one another. Which is very fucking sad.
Yeah.
Mitch actually had children who were visiting town at the time. And while waiting for their father and his partner to return, they watched the same movie 7 times in a row. And this was Disney's The World's Greatest Athlete. Eventually, a friend came and picked them up and drove them to the airport to go home to their mother without telling them what had happened.
Yeah, I was reading an article where the son was like, there was a point in the night where I started to realize something was wrong because I think they were like 11 and 7 or something. Mm-hmm. And the older one like could sense something was like bad was happening.
Yeah.
And it was really sad.
One of the survivors, a man named Ricky Everett, had managed to escape from the rooftop through the back exit. When he made it to the ground, it took him a minute to be able to see as his eyes were filled with tears from the smoke. But once he was able to see, he witnessed people jumping from the windows and hitting the ground below. And remember, they're on the second story.
Mm-hmm.
He later recalled, they had all that space for people lying there on the street and they were pulling the burning clothes off of them.
Firefighters that were stationed 2 blocks away tried getting to the scene of the fire, but were blocked by car and pedestrian traffic. One fire truck tried to maneuver around the traffic by going up onto a sidewalk, but ended up crashing into a taxi cab. Once the fire trucks were able to get to the scene, they saw people struggling to get out of the security bars on the windows and were able to quickly put out the fire. The fire, in total, lasted about 16 minutes. Overall, 32 people died as a result of the fire, 31 men and 1 woman. 28 people died on scene, and 1 died while on the way to the hospital, and 3 would die later from injuries. 15 other individuals sustained injuries from the fire, smoke inhalation, and jumping from the windows. Most of the bodies inside were found huddled up against the windows, dying while trying to escape. And the majority of the people who died within the fire's first 6 minutes. The fire resulted in the death of 1/3 of the congregation of the MCC, which is a pretty large portion of your congregation.
It really is.
After the fire was put out, many of the surviving patrons gathered together to help rescue or help anyone they could. There are photos that can be seen where patrons were grabbing gurneys and medical equipment out of ambulances while police officers just stood in the background observing. Fire investigators reported finding an empty bottle of lighter fluid at the base of the stairs and assessed that the wooden stairs that were over 100 years old would have immediately soaked up the lighter fluid. The fire was the deadliest fire in New Orleans history at the time and was the largest mass killing of LGBT people in American history until the Pulse shooting in Orlando in 2016.
So there were a couple witnesses to the fire that weren't inside of the building. The first witness was the attendant at the Walgreens store where the bottle of lighter fluid was purchased. And she would later identify a man in his mid-20s with dark brown hair, medium build, and ruddy complexion who entered the store and asked about lighter fluid. She said that he seemed visibly drunk and upset, but she showed him the different bottles of lighter fluid and he purchased a 7-ounce can of Ronsonol lighter fluid. And like she said that she was aware that he was drunk and like she probably shouldn't be helping him, but she was like, you know, it's just the end of the day, like she was going on break soon. She's like, he's just asking about lighter fluid. It's not like I'm serving him alcohol or anything.
Also, what are you gonna do, say no, I'm not gonna sell you lighter fluid? I don't think you can really do that. Maybe you can, but that just feels like weird.
But she did say that she seemed like kind of weirded out by him. It's not something you could do anything about it, but she got like a real weird vibe.
She got
from
a vibe from him. That's good that she like could sense something though.
Another witness named Harold Bartholomew was driving his children home from an event downtown when he hit traffic by the upstairs lounge. When he noticed someone pointing, he rolled down his window and first off heard people yelling and honking their horns and stuff. But then he heard someone yell, "I'm telling you, you better get out of here," and saw two men exit the entrance of the upstairs lounge. And then one of the men said, "That'll fix the motherfuckers." As traffic started moving and he was finally like parallel with the lounge, Harold stopped when he heard his children scream and saw black smoke pouring out from the entrance of the upstairs lounge. Another witness, Catherine Kirsch, who lived across the street from the lounge, had stepped outside to smoke a cigarette when she heard someone yell fire. She then saw flames on the top step of the upstairs lounge at around 7:53 p.m. She immediately began yelling and ran into the nearest bar, which was the midship, to try and get help. A retired soldier ran out of the bar to assess the fire, thinking maybe it was a small fire that he could put out with a pitcher of water. When he realized that the bottom three steps were already engulfed in flames and quickly spreading, he ran back into the midship to tell the barmaid to call the emergency fire number, as 911 didn't exist in New Orleans at this time. After this, he ran back to the scene of the fire to see that it had already spread up to the top of the stairwell. He later told the State's Item, which is a local newspaper, it sounded like firecrackers going off in there. That stairway was gone.
So, the only suspect really in the fire was Roger Dale Nunez, the man who had been kicked out of the bar a mere 30 minutes before the fire erupted. The bartender, Buddy, who had managed to get out of the bar, immediately thought of Nunez as a suspect and started running through the streets to find him. He actually ended up finding him at another bar named Wanda's. Buddy grabbed Nunez and asked him where he had been. He answered that he had been at Wanda's, but Buddy grabbed him and drug him out of the bar into a plainclothes police officer, explaining to him the situation that erupted before the fire broke out and that Nunez should be held for questioning. Another man, Courtney Craighead, also tried explaining to the officer what had happened with Nunez, but the officer basically just shooed them away, saying, "Move along." So Buddy let Nunez go and later said, "I couldn't convince the policeman that he should hold this person, and I let him go." The fire marshal report said the police officer told Courtney Craighead that he didn't have the authority to restrain the subject and referred him to the lieutenant that was standing across the street from them in front of the Walgreens. This did happen, and when the two went up to the lieutenant and told him the story, the officer yelled, You think you know police business better than I? After muttering something into his walkie-talkie, he turned back and told them, go back across the street. You're in the way. And then Buddy and Courtney watched Nunez disappear into the crowd of people.
So, a little bit of background on Nunez. He was described as a local hustler and a troublemaker. And in 1970, he was diagnosed with conversion hysteria and visited numerous psychiatric clinics. He was released from one of these facilities a year before the fire. Nunez was questioned by police shortly after the fire, but was in the hospital and couldn't respond. When police were finally able to question him, they said he never appeared nervous during the interrogation. Nunez brought forth a witness who said he had been in and out of the bar during the 10 to 20 minutes before the fire, and that he saw no one leave or enter the building.
Mm-hmm.
Police said this man was visibly stressed, so they dismissed him as a liar. Nunez was arrested and placed into psychiatric custody. While in custody, he escaped, and the police literally just never picked him up again.
Yeah.
And this wasn't because he was, like, hiding out. He just continued to show up in the French Quarter, live his life, go to bars, and nothing was done.
Yeah.
One friend later told investigators that Nunez confessed to starting the fire on at least four occasions. He told this friend that he squirted the bottom steps with the Rossinol lighter fluid, which he purchased from the local Walgreens store, and then tossed a match. He did say that Nunez admitted that he didn't expect the whole building to go up in flames, though. Nunez would later die by suicide in 1974, so a year later. And the investigation lasted 2 months. And in the end, they reported that there was speculation of arson, aka the fucking lighter fluid.
Yeah.
But there was no physical evidence to indicate anything other than the fire being from an undetermined origin, and the case was closed.
Yeah.
Like, what?
It doesn't make any sense.
Like, the firefighters say they clearly smell lighter fluid. They found a bottle of lighter fluid.
Yeah.
Like, but they can suspect it's arson, but there's no physical evidence.
Yeah.
Fuck you.
And you found the physical bottle of the lighter fluid, like, at the crime scene.
Exactly.
So, but definitely no physical evidence for sure.
It's so frustrating.
And although this was a tragic loss of life, there was little local and national attention. Neither the mayor or governor spoke out about the upstairs lounge fire, and most religious leaders were also silent on the matter, even though a notable amount of church members had died in the fire as well. The reason that the governor and mayor not speaking out was notable was 2 months earlier, there had actually been two fires that had occurred in New Orleans with less deaths, and they both made statements about how these events were tragic losses of life. But that's not for this one.
No, of course not. Because in the 70s, when it's all peace, love, and happiness,
we can't give anyone human decency.
Exactly. They still hate gay people.
Yeah. The fire was on the front page of newspapers for only 2 days and was quickly forgotten about. After the fire, many people in the gay community accused the fire department of not responding immediately and refused to touch the bodies of many of the victims. The chief of detectives told reporters that identifying the bodies would be tough and said in regards to the bar, some thieves hung out there. And, you know, this was a queer bar. Like,
okay, yeah.
Yeah. It's like they're thieves and thugs because they are gay.
Apparently.
You right. And many churches and funeral homes refused to hold funerals for the deceased. There was only one congregation in the French Quarter who agreed to hold a memorial service right after the event. Reverend William P. Richardson of St. George's Episcopal Church agreed to hold a small prayer service for the victims on June 25th and around 80 people attended the event. The next day, Iveson B. Noland, who was the Episcopal Bishop of New Orleans, criticized Richardson for holding the service. Noland received about 100 complaints from parishioners about the service, and Reverend Richardson's mailbox was filled with hate mail.
That's insane.
Yeah. Shortly after, on July 1st, two more services were held at local churches for the victims, and MCC founder Troy Perry came from Los Angeles to participate. As a demonstration, mourners who attended the services chose to exit through the main doors of the church to be on camera, as opposed to sneaking out through a side exit door, which is like a nice, like, silent protest, you know? There was only one funeral home that accepted the victims, the Jacob Schoen and Son Funeral Home. Several families did not come forward to claim the bodies of their deceased relatives, being ashamed of them being gay.
That is, like, the saddest fucking part. It is. Because these people were unidentified and just forgotten about because they were gay.
Yeah, like, it was so shameful that they just didn't care. Some friends were able to identify some of the bodies based on hotel room keys or jewelry that they were wearing, but a lot of the bodies remained unidentified. It was also rumored that some of the men threw their wallets into the fire in order for their identity to not be found out, as they didn't want to be known for being gay. Some anonymous people paid for burials of some of the victims, but a lot of them ended up being buried in mass graves. One victim of the fire was a local teacher, and he was fired while in critical care once the school learned that he was gay, and 2 days later he passed away. So, like, not only did he just go through this horrific, traumatizing event, but then his school fires him for being a part of this horrific, traumatizing event, and then he passes away. Like, it's just so fucked up.
It is. And, like, I just have to keep reminding myself that, again, this was in the 70s. It's not like this was in, like, the 30s.
Yeah.
This was in the 70s.
Yeah.
So, one story that came out about the unidentified victims involved the family of Ferris LeBlanc. It took 42 years for his sister, Marilyn LeBlanc, to even know that he had died in the fire.
Yeah.
Her son, Bailey, was actually the one who discovered Ferris's fate after his mother said that she had heard that there was something on the internet about Ferris in 2015. So, Bailey searched his uncle's name on the internet and discovered the list of victims that had died in the fire, which contained Ferris's name. Ferris had been identified by a friend who was able to name him by a unique ring that he wore. But the family was never notified, meaning the body was never claimed, and he ended up being buried in a mass unmarked grave with three unidentified men. Bailey recalls finding out what happened to his uncle. Quote, "We'd always wondered what happened to him. We had no idea. Knowing what happened, it was good to know that we finally found out. But by the same token, it was so horrible to be burned alive. It's just unimaginable. And it was very, very devastating. I found it on the computer, and in tears, I went into the other room and told my mom. I said, we now know what's happened, and we just broke down. And then I said, you know what we have to do? We have to find him, and we have to bring him home. That's what our goal is," unquote.
That's really nice.
It is.
Like, it's a really sad story, but it's also really nice that they finally, like, found out answers.
Yeah, this, I don't know how old he was when he did this interview, but the nephew of this guy had a lot of really, like, soulful things to say.
Yeah.
And, like, he talked about his memories of him and stuff like that.
That's nice.
It was really nice. So, the grave that Ferris is in is still unmarked.
Mm-hmm.
And after Hurricane Katrina, the cemetery lost a lot of its records where people were buried, including Ferris LeBlanc. The family was able to find some footage of the actual burials, but only about 5 seconds shows individual plots and coffins, but they were like, it's more to work with than what we had before.
Mm-hmm.
And this would give them a better chance to be able to get permission from a judge to try and dig and find the body. In 2018, the family was still looking for answers on where Ferris was buried. And Bailey said of the way things were handled after the fire, quote, "The aftermath of the fire, the way it was handled regarding the victims, their families, and friends was horrible. They were treated like non-humans. I mean, it was just a horrible way to treat people. Of course, we didn't know any of that. We didn't know he was even there. We didn't even know he was in New Orleans. We had no idea. And now, looking back and reading all the books and seeing what happened to him, that was an awful way to be treated. It's inhumane." Going to the end of that, and in 2018, they still hadn't found the body, and that was the last I could find.
Mm-hmm.
In June of 1998, the 25th anniversary of the fire, as part of Gay Pride celebrations, a memorial service was organized by Reverend Dexter Brecht of Big Easy Metropolitan Community Church alongside Tony J.P. Pizzani. It was held at the Royal Sonesta Hotel Grand Ballroom. New Orleans Councilman Troy Carter then led a jazz funeral procession to the building on the corner of Chartus and Iberville Streets, the site of the club, and the members of the local MCC laid a memorial plaque and wreaths at the grave. And as like a nice kind of ending note, Buddy Rasmussen has moved to a rural location with his husband, and they've been married for 40 years now, and they spend their time growing vegetables, volunteering at food banks, and sitting out on their back porch.
Yeah, and he doesn't really like to talk about the fire at all. He asks like people not ask him about it. But he's just like living his life with his husband, and that's nice.
Yeah, I read that like there were a couple of survivors that spoke at one event, but the majority of the survivors and the families like did not speak of it at all, don't want to be asked about it.
Yeah.
Like the same as Buddy.
It was like very traumatic for them.
Definitely.
And that's very understandable.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah, I like that story a lot, especially because it was one I had never heard of. And it wasn't like a hate crime, but it's still like true crime that happened, you know? I think we often like just think of true crime has to be like a specific angle, but it's not. And sometimes it's just really shitty, sad things like this.
Yeah. And like we said before, the hate is what really happened afterwards.
Yeah, it was just like the amount of disrespect that was given towards the victims, and it's just, it's fucked up.
Exactly.
But as a way to take us out on higher spirits, I'm going to give you a Florida man story. Our fellow Floridians here doing it up even during quarantine,
making us proud.
This one actually did make me laugh, though. It was just so dumb. Florida man carrying nearly 500 grams of weed tries to steal plane to meet girlfriend.
That's a fucking sentence.
Yeah. In New Smyrna Beach, Florida, a Florida man is behind bars after he attempted to steal an airplane at the New Smyrna Beach Municipal Airport so he could fly to California to meet his girlfriend while carrying nearly 500 grams of marijuana. On Saturday, officers were alerted that a stolen vehicle had been found at the airport, and while in the process of locating that vehicle, officers were flagged down by a man who said that it was his vehicle that was stolen. The victim told officers that a man unknown to him jumped into the back of his truck and offered him $1,000 for a ride. The man then got out of the truck, but left a grinder, scale, and cell phone behind.
Smart.
At the same time, the victim flagged down officers to describe the incident in the truck, another officer at the airport was notified by a flight instructor that a man with a big blue bag was spotted crouching on the wing of a plane station on a portion of the tarmac that was not accessible to the public. According to a report, the man asked the flight instructor how he could fly a plane.
Wow.
Yeah. This man was just like, I'm out here.
Yes.
By the time officers reached the tarmac, the man was sitting in the right seat of the aircraft. When officers approached him, he again asked if they knew how to fly the plane. He then jumped from the emergency exit window and was immediately detained by officers. And this man was 22-year-old Robert Stienstra.
22.
Yeah.
A little baby.
And they also found in his duffel bag his ID, sunglasses, headphones, some cigarillos, two lighters, a pocket knife, and a laptop. And a glass pipe was found and tested for methamphetamine. And it was positive. So he was just living his best life trying to get that weed to his girlfriend in California, who truthfully, I feel like, could get him better weed than he would be bringing to her.
And also, like, I know that, like, weed is measured in, like, grams and ounces and stuff. Mm-hmm. But when you say 500 grams, like, I'm thinking...
Grounds?
500 grams. I'm thinking this, like, huge amount, but I looked it up and it's just a pound.
Yeah, it's not that much.
I was like a pound I think they specifically put
500 grams to make it sound like a bigger amount than it was. But, like, it wasn't like he was smuggling mass amounts of marijuana, but he was really trying to steal a plane to get his girlfriend a small amount of weed in California when she has plenty of access where it's recreationally allowed.
That's so funny.
Yeah, that one just really tickled me because the just like sitting on the plane wing and making your way in, it's just like, a great time.
Hey, do you know how to fly a plane?
Yeah.
Police officer comes, can you help me fly this plane?
Can you guys just teach me how to fly this plane really quick? It'll be really quick and I'll get out of your hair.
Yeah. I'll give you this weed. You teach me how.
Yeah.
You fly me to California. You take the plane back.
All right, guys. That has been our episode for this week. We hope that you are able to enjoy your Pride Month in some way. If you are a fellow member of the LGBT community. And we also hope that you continue to educate yourself on other matters like the current prison situations and things like that going on in our country.
Exactly.
And just constantly be learning. We stopped learning when we got out of school. We stopped actively seeking out knowledge.
You're not wrong.
You know? So actively seek out some fucking knowledge.
Exactly. Like, there is so much going on in the world right now.
Yeah.
That, like, you can even spend 5 minutes and have a world of knowledge of difference.
Yeah. And on top of this, I've been doing, like, a lot of inward reflection. Mm-hmm. And let me tell y'all, inward reflection is really hard.
Oh, yeah.
And it really sucks. And it's very uncomfortable. And all weekend, I just kept cringing at things I've done, like, in the past 20 years of my life. And just, it was a real spiral. But I also feel a little bit better now, you know?
Yeah. I literally did that right before we started recording when I had that conversation with you.
Yeah.
And you were just like, it's fine.
Now we good.
We can do this. But yeah, we hope that you guys also found this interesting and learned something new if you didn't know about this case like we didn't.
Yeah.
And you can find us on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at Crime Binge or Crime Binge Podcast. We are at Gmail at crimebinge@gmail.com.
Yeah.
And please, pretty please, rate and review on Apple iTunes.
Yep.
We did get a couple and they were really nice and we would love to have a couple more for this month.
Yeah. And keep on binging. Bye.
See ya.